What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on DLive, DLive.com/Dave Martell. So make sure you click the little follow down there so you can follow and get an alert every time we go live, which is every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. If you're watching the rewind on YouTube, make sure you like, subscribe, share. We're going live every single Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern, and I upload on YouTube as well to do premieres so everybody can see it over there. So anyway, tonight we have a very special episode. We have a very cool episode, an episode that's very highly requested. So, you know, I hope everybody's staying healthy out there, man. There's, you know, crazy stuff going on. So, you know, hail Mother Frigg and hail Eider. And I hope that, you know, everybody's staying healthy, staying safe out there, staying well fed. And to alleviate some of your guys' anxiety, because I know it's really negative and stressful out there. It's pretty tense out there. So to alleviate, we have a special episode tonight. We're going to talk about something that's a little less stressful, a little less scary than coronavirus, and that's the end of the world. So I hope everybody sits back and relaxes as we talk about the literal end of days, or the cycle that comes to the end of the days. So tonight it's just me and Tristan. So how are we doing tonight, Mr. Tristan?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing all right. Had a little bit of sickness going on there for a minute. I'm feeling better now. Hopefully, I don't have the chan. Hopefully, nobody has the chan. Hopefully, everybody's nice and healthy. How you feeling over there?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, actually, the week or two ago when we were doing it, I had a bit of a congestion going on, but I'm getting better.
Yeah, everybody's dealing with like these lingering colds and lingering sinus
infections. Yeah, it's just the season.
It's a bad one, though, obviously.
and I'm not sure if you heard, there's this global pandemic going on.
Oh, really? That's I should probably, you know, look into that and see what's going on. You know, not like it's on the news every 5 minutes and the entire front page of Google is, you know, lined up with that. And, you know, we can't get away from hearing about it. It's just bombarding us every second of our waking life. So anyway, let's talk about the end of the world. Let's get on to some easier topics. So, Ragnarok. Tristan, what is Ragnarok?
So Ragnarok is a mythic element in the Nordic corpus that people often like to speak about, but most people don't really have a good understanding of. Like, they don't read the Völuspá and all the elements that go into it. So today we're going to be discussing exactly what Ragnarok says, what precedes it, what elements are there, and basically what it is about. How we can tell is Ragnarok happening.
Yeah, and then also at halftime, we have an episode from our very favorite Southern gentleman, the Folkish Farmer. He's got a little special, a coronavirus special for us. He was going to talk to us about, you guys will see, you guys are really going to like it. It's a good episode, good stuff. He's always got great knowledge and wisdom for us.
Yeah, Farmer always makes the most delicious looking stuff. Yeah. And towards the end here, we also have a bunch of Q&As from when we put up the video. Unfortunately, guys, we weren't just ignoring you. YouTube basically messed around with us and marked them all as spam, and we just now figured out that you guys had them. So we're going to answer a few of them.
Yeah, so sorry to everybody left comment. I was like, yo, we were going to plan on doing a Q&A show, and then I was like, you know, nobody commented. Like, you're fine, no Q&A show then. Like, I was kind of salty about it. Well, like, literally just a few hours ago, I saw that I had like 20-something comments on that video, and
right, there's a bunch of comments, and they're all really good. We were seeing nothing. Like, no one had any comments.
Yeah. Shout out to Roy, who just donated a diamond. He says, hail. Hail to you, Mr. Roy. Many blessings and much health to you, sir. So, let's get right into Ragnarok. What is Ragnarok?
Ragnarok is the twilight of the gods. And the fate and the end at the end of time for them, for the gods, which will precede a golden age and the rebirth of the world.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't realize, especially like you see on the screen, the Setian wheel there with, you know, all the runes and the six spokes and all that. What that wheel means is every single rune on there signifies one of the ages. It goes through, it starts with the Ur Age at the top, and then it goes to the Golden Age, and then I believe the Copper Age, the Silver Age, missing one, Copper Age, Silver Age, Iron Age, Wolf Age, and then that's it, I believe. So that is signifying, the Setian wheel itself signifies the ages that we go through, the ages of the cycle of existence, the cycle of civilization, the cycle of our folk. And, you know, at the center of the wheel, there is the Othala rune, which Othala means as like a tradition, as somebody's ties to something, a transgenerational tie. And that's kind of...
I always describe it as your sacred inheritance. It could be anything from your blood, your traits, you know, your hair color, to jewelry, weapons, land.
Yeah.
Anything that you inherit from your ancestors and which has a sacral quality.
Knowledge.
Knowledge.
It could be something as simple as a song. It could be a recipe. You know, it could be anything. It could be something real simple. But what it means is, Tristan's right, he put it very articulately, you know, it's an ancestral inheritance. A sacred ancestral inheritance. And what that means, being at the pivot of the wheel, the axle, I guess you could say, is that we all, whether we like it or not, inherit all of these things. This is part of the cycle. And we can't escape it. It's just what it is. And also, you know, a lot of people, when they think about Ragnarok, they think of it as this big, scary time. And it's literally Armageddon and like all. And it kind of is. But you also have to remember that it is a very sacred time, and it is a time that is not forever. It's not linear. It's not over. That's how the you know, the world works. Speaking of Folkish Farmer, he says, awesome topic, y'all. Gives us a Ningini. We haven't had one of those yet. What's a Ningini?
A Ningini is 10 diamonds, so wow. Farmer's making it rain on us over here.
Yo, he make it rain, baby. Yeah. That's how... So anyway, back to Ragnarok. What it really is, it's not something to be terrified of. It's not the end of all things. It is, and a lot of people really theorize it. I do it as well. This is my gnosis, that Ragnarok also describes glacial maximums, also describes the Ice Age, where that wipes out all of the stuff on the planet, or, you know, wipes out a lot of the stuff on the planet before it gets back into another warm lull.
Yeah, you know, and there's many different ways you could possibly interpret the prophecies of Ragnarok. I've always been rather keen that a lot of them have to do with heat and cold and stuff, and they do seem to comport very well with how we might imagine the world would end in the modern day with, like, you know, nuclear exchanges of fire and nuclear winter and all that stuff.
Yeah. Or like volcanoes. And a lot of times it points to earthquakes, seismic activity. And as we all know, is when the Earth has a great climate shift, we see in geology that there are great, there's great movement in the rock and stuff like that. That's something that we see. So there's a lot that goes into it, you know, whether or not we're all going to die or anything like that. That's kind of like a Hollywoodization. And also, Ragnarok is part of an age that lasts who knows how long. And we're going to get into the Kali Yuga a little bit in a few minutes here. And we're going to talk about the comparisons between the Wolf Age and Ragnarok and the Kali Yuga. And we're going to clear up some stuff about the Kali Yuga, some misunderstandings about the Kali Yuga. And we're going to go through and we're going to talk about all the aspects of the Kali Yuga and like all that stuff. But so Ragnarok, when does it happen?
Right.
Like, tell us more about it, Tristan.
Right, so Ragnarok is most described in the Völuspá, in the 41st paragraph is when it starts, and it says, "There feeds he full on the flesh of the dead, and the home of the gods he reddens with gore. Dark grows the sun, and in summer soon come mighty storms, you know yet more."
Yeah.
So here we see that, I believe from context, they're talking about the great dragon who feeds at the bottom of the world, who rips apart the Neethings here, and when he comes up, he will devour all of them. Finally, he'll be so gorged upon them. The sun will go dark when Suna is eaten by, I believe it's Skoll, who chases her across the sky. And summer will have these mighty storms that come in and batter and destroy everything. So basically climate change.
Yeah. The sun goes dark, grand solar minimum. You know, mighty, mighty storms. That's what happens, is the climate shifts. What happens during a grand solar minimum is kind of the places that were warm then, you know, become cold. So you have warm fronts and cold fronts moving around, the atmosphere is shifting, and you have immense, immense storms immense storms. In fact, I saw I was watching a video talking about one of the more recent solar minimums, and they have record. They could see ripples in the mud that during this solar minimum, there was a storm so bad in, I believe it was, it's here in America. It was like, I believe it was like somewhere down in the southeast where there was a desert. But anyway, they can record that there was this, there, it rained and it stormed in this region so bad during that solar minimum that there was a flood, which there never is there. And the flood from it, the flash flood from it, was so bad that they could record like the ripples that were left in the mud from the force of this storm, like the wind blowing the water and like the flash flooding and stuff. It pushed the dirt and the stone so much that it left like giant like imprints in the mud from the force of this water. And it's just incredible. It's incredible how much. Mother Nature can do to the earth, and how much of a fingerprint she can leave behind.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, most people just see the results of Mother Nature. It's been there for so long that we don't really look at it and think, wow, that actually happened. But when you really do think about it, I mean, imagine the Grand Canyon. That was all hollowed out by wind and rain over eons and millennia. And I mean, it carved just a big wound through the earth. I mean, that's powerful tectonic stuff right there. The Mother Nature is no joke. It is very powerful, and it will squish you like a bug.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. So that's what happens during your great climate upheaval. And me personally, that's how I interpret. Like Tristan literally said the passage about Ragnarok, and he said, you know, there's mighty storms when summer comes. And then he also says the sun goes dark. That, to me, says grand solar minimum. That's, to me, says...
Right. It should be noted here that when they talk about storms in summer, this is something that would be very unusual for our ancestors in the north. Summer would be the time for war and other such activities when storms and winter was not present. So summer storms would be something that was so widely out of the norm that it would basically affect society massively.
Yeah. And you had another passage that was in the show notes,
right,
from Voluspa, actually.
Right, from Voluspa, with a couple paragraphs later, and it says, "Brothers will fight and kill each other. Sisters' children would defile kinship. It is harsh in the world, whoredom rife. An axe age, a sword age, shields are riven. A wind age, a wolf age, before the world goes headlong. No man will have mercy on another."
Yeah, and what's that? What that's describing? Great chaos among people. Yeah, you know, that's you know, the and this is something that we're gonna take note of, that first part there about I'm not familiar with the translation Tristan used, but it's the
Ursula Dronk translation.
Yeah,
it's my personal favorite.
Yeah, I like Lee Hollander, and I also like who's the other lady? She's pretty good too. Doesn't matter. All translation, not all, but most translations you get are gonna be. At least get you the message.
They're all basically the same. It's just a matter of stringing the right, you know, the good sounding words together. I just prefer this one, so I grabbed it.
Yeah.
But I mean, they all say the same thing. None of them disagree about the content.
Yeah. So what they're describing here is, and I want you guys to make a mental note of this part about, it says, like, I don't remember a translation, but in the one I can remember, it's brother fights brother and kinship stain. Something like along those lines. Hard it is on earth with mighty whoredom. And it's describing extreme promiscuity. It's describing no family structure. It's describing people that are tied by familial bonds, attacking one another. You know, no respect for authority, no respect for anything. They just fight, and they're whoring, and they're just, it's just terrible. It's just a terrible time. And making mental note of that for when we get into talking about the Kali Yuga.
Right. It is here describing basically a total abandonment of the sacral law that our people lived by, which is something I always try to impress on others, that our ancestors very much did have law. Bernt Nau in his saga says that it is with law that our land will be built up and prosperous. Our ancestors very much followed a specific law, and we've talked even on the program here about how totally unthinkable it was for them that brothers would fight and kill each other, that kinsmen would destroy the bonds of frith and make up their own family, that our Germanic ancestors basically couldn't even process or understand the concept even occurring, except in maybe tragic instances of like ignorance where they didn't even know who the identity of the person they were fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. And for people that are like, oh my God, this is coming, you know, the end of the world is gonna, like, it's gonna be a big explosion and all that stuff. Keep in mind that these are ages that happen over thousands of years. If you think that we're about to get into a time where people are fighting each other and people haven't respected their sacred bonds and stuff like that, let me remind you that the Enlightenment era style of thought that have brought about the upheaval and the disrespect of sacral bonds and of sacred authority and stuff like that, that was, you know, a few hundred years ago.
Right. I mean, it's been here in some form for 400 years now. I mean, people always like to have a narcissistic perspective on time where they think like every generation believes, oh, it's definitely during my generation when the world's going to end. Right. But it so far, at least, it never has. And it always just continues and it gets worse. And trust me, it can get worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're coming up on an age now that, technology is going to change things. You know, I predicted a couple years ago, I said, in the next couple decades, us like millennials and Gen Xers and stuff, when we start becoming old men and women, we are going to look at our reality and we're going to think that this looks unrecognizable from what it did 10, 20, 30 years ago. In our lifetime.
And, you know, part of the that thing you were talking about how it's a part of an age of cycles. In the Hindu understanding, there are even cycles within cycles. So there's supposed to be a great golden age during the middle of the Kali Yuga in which everything apparently gets better. And, you know, it's like a rebirth of virtue and righteousness that eventually falls and goes, you know, plummets even harder back to the end of the Kali Yuga.
And that's pretty strange because the next thing I was actually going to mention, Mr. Tristan, was Prabhupada's. I guess he had laid out a prophecy, I guess you could say, or a prediction that there would be a golden age within the Kali Yuga and we would see it very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've always thought that maybe that would be the golden age is when we're coming here. But of course, I have to go back to my own narcissistic perspective of time. Of course, we would think that, you know, the golden age is now, of course. But the great, you know, like space exploration and the great, you know, benefits and automation we have, it looks like we might be able to change the world in ways that our ancestors never dreamed of. Maybe this is the golden age. Who knows?
And I've been saying that for people that have been watching me for a long time, and I've been saying this for years.
Just think of it like this. Our faith hasn't been seen in general public for 1,000 years, and yet here we are.
I'm like running into people in public that are, heathens or Odinic or that follow the ancestral path. I am running into people in public. I am seeing people in like I'm in a bunch of chats on Telegram. Most of them have nothing to do with our circles or our religion or anything. I'm seeing people, you know, with like Odinic names. I'm seeing people in comment sections on YouTube on how to's with Odinic names. I'm running into people in public that are wearing Mjolnirs. You know, I'm running into people. One of the novitiates of my kindred, he just met somebody at his work, found out that he was a practitioner of the old ways. So it's like, dude, this is the Great Awakening. Don't get it twisted. Like, yes, we might be in the Kali Yuga. This might be the Wolf Age for us. Followers of Odin, followers of the Ice Seer, we are on the cusp of our golden age. It's coming. It's here. And this is going to be a beautiful time because as our faith rises and comes back to prominence and as our gods get back on their deserving thrones and this becomes a cultural standard that it once was, it is going to coincide in parallel with a great advancement of technology that is never seen before in human history. This could be the greatest time that man has ever seen. And you know, don't get it twisted that, right now, it's pretty gross. You know, we're all pretty worked up about the virus. It sucks. You know, it's I'm not going to get it twisted. The virus is probably worse than what they're telling you on the news. It's probably going to end up being worse. This is probably our plague of the generation. But the overwhelming majority of us will survive. And those of us that do survive, and, you know, I'm going to survive, you're going to survive, a lot of the public out there, not a lot, but a good chunk of the public, unfortunately, are going to hit hard times. If they don't, and when I say survive, I don't mean just die from the virus, but I mean they are going to, if they don't get messed up from the virus, they are going to suffer from the aftermath of the virus, which is going to be far worse. It's going to be the economic implications. It's going to be breakdown of law. There's going to be all kinds of political implications. It's going to be a mess after this thing's over. But us, right here, you guys, me, Tristan, the Sedian community, the Also True community, we are going to reach a time. This is our time to shine, man. I believe that. And I'm sorry for getting on the soapbox here for a minute, Tristan, but I believe
that. No, it's all right. Yeah, I mean, we have to remember here that the Golden Age was supposed to last for 10,000 years. I mean, it's hard to even imagine conceptualizing 10,000 years. I mean, that would be from us back before people even knew how to farm.
Yeah, that's you know, that really makes you question the validity of the human timeline that we're taught, doesn't it?
What, that, you know, less than 10,000 years ago, people invented agriculture? Well, you know, I was going to go into it about the Kali Yuga we were talking about here with the Indian section. So this is a good part to transition there.
Yeah,
that
go into it.
Some of the timelines in the Indian sections can differ very dramatically between sources and even amongst each other. And a lot of them use timelines that are on the scales of, like, millions of years, which, you know, like, if you believe, like, the Mahabharata was composed, like, you know, 2.5 million years ago, like, I'm just going to be clear, like, you know, that's not possible according to science, right? So, and it also conflicts with other different timescales within the Hindu corpuses. I prefer to view it as metaphorical timelines in which they have a sort of a poetic resonance, or that there's some sort of numerological significance in that, you know, if we say 2.5 million years ago, what it really means is a very long time, very, very hard to even conceptualize when everything was very, very different.
Now, I will say there is a lot of evidence that shows extreme human antiquity on a level that completely flies in the face of modern science. They have found human remains in layers of rock that are dated to be like a couple million years old, like modern humans. Like we're talking, you know, you have a ball on the heel, you have opposable thumbs, you upright skull just like ours. There's not an overwhelming, but there's more than what can be ignored, and more than what could be a hoax. And if you go look at the case studies for these, I'll compile them sometime. We could do a whole show about it, but the explanations for this evidence get downright ridiculous. So they say, oh well, that's a hoax. Oh well, that was just somebody that was buried too deep. Oh well, that evidence is too old. There's always just like some, you know, half-assed excuse to why, you know, extreme human antiquity can't be true. Now, I'm not saying it is 100% true, but I'm saying that it's possible.
Well, I mean, anything's possible here, and if it does comport well with what the, you know, like the Vedas and the other sources say, that would be rather interesting because, at least amongst the people I talk to in the Indian community, this is a very much of a sticking point about how much of the time scales and what they say about history and whatnot can be empirically verified.
Yeah, and it's just there's so much. And I was having a conversation, actually, the same guy that I was mentioning, the novitiate, my kindred, he was looking at something that was described in the Eddas. I can't remember exactly detail. We can bring him on sometimes. Really, really smart, interesting guy. But he was describing something to me that he found in the Eddas. He's also a member of the Nirvana Society now, and he found that they're describing a seismic event in the Eddas that happened in the Northern Hemisphere. Like, we're talking like upwards of a million years ago. And it's like it describes the location, describes like all this stuff. I have to bring them on that we could talk about. It's really, really interesting. I don't want to do it any disservice describing anymore and getting the details wrong. But if his theory is correct, how the heck is it that people a million years ago remembered this story for that long that they wrote it down? Or is it that this story was written down a million years ago and our people were in that region a million years
ago? Well, another option here is just straight up divine intervention here that, of course, the gods were there, right? The gods have always been there, much longer than people anyway.
Yeah.
So when the gods came and delivered these stories to man, they could have been telling him, well, this is what I saw. This is what happened before mankind was even there.
Yeah, that's another really fair point. So let's go through. I thought we were gonna, not have enough time, or we were gonna have too much time. But we're starting to run out of time. Let's get into the Kali Yuga.
Right now, first, when we talk about the Kali Yuga, I would like to correct something here. People often mistake because I believe it was Julius Evola who made this mistake and popularized it, and people just keep repeating it over and over. The Kali part of the Kali Yuga does not refer to the goddess Kali Ma. It refers to the demon Kali. And I mean, there's a difference in the pronunciation with, like, if you see it in Sanskrit, they have different diuretics and whatever. I think Kali Ma is actually pronounced Kali Ma and the demon is pronounced Kali. But don't hold me to that. I mean, there's some sort of pronunciation difference, but they are very different people. The Kali Yuga is not the age of the goddess Kali. It's the age of the demon Kali, who is a demon that embodies the sloth and evil and chaos and licentiousness of the age.
So is he like Slaanesh?
Yeah, he's basically Slaanesh.
So would he be equivalent to like a Lokian character?
Yeah, I mean, he's actually somewhat similar to... I guess Loki, I mean, it's really hard to say like what sort of cognate figure would be in the Nordic corpus because it doesn't quite have the same standard. Loki might be the best figure to put him on. Maybe like a combination between Loki and Gullveig, like some great force of like evil and injustice that can be fought against by the gods. Maybe even like representing the entirety of the Jotnar.
Now, speaking of Gullveig, this is one thing I brought up, and a lot of people got a little worked up about it. Was in Ragnarok. The Thursas rise, which is Loki and his children. Gullveig is one of his children. Well, Gullveig, when she was, when they say that she was burned, she would come back, she burned. One of her names, I can't remember off the top of my head, literally means like giver of poison or something like that. She was spreading poison throughout the land. Well, when the Thursas rise, Gullveig will also rise. And Gullveig will spread poison or sickness. It also means sickness throughout the lands. So, we're looking at great sickness going throughout the lands with Gullveig.
Right. I mean, we have to remember that all of the medieval stereotypes around the witch, like they corrupt people and, have adultery and have like all these rituals that fuck people up and poison wells and all these stereotypes you think from the medieval period. These are exactly what our people believed about trolls and sorcerers as well. And Gullveig is, in fact, a sorceress. These people are... they have a specific bloodline that it's mentioned that they come from, that they're not quite human. They come from the Jotnar, just like Gullveig does, because Loki is also Jotnar.
Yeah. So, if you run into anybody who calls themselves Thursatru or something like that, it's absolutely ridiculous for somebody to be something like that. And if they say that they're Thursatru, that means they're your enemy. They worship the enemies of the gods. They worship sickness.
They are, in fact, your enemy. And I would have advice for you, but we'd have to be talking about things you would have to do in Minecraft.
It's absolutely ridiculous and disgusting. And why anybody would worship entities that bring death and destruction and chaos and evil and destroy families and destroy nations and destroy everything that we uphold to be noble and good. Well, anybody would worship that is just sick and disgusting. And, don't come around me if you're one of them. That's all I'm going to say. Don't come around me. Don't come around my kindred. You're not going to have a good time. So back to the Kali Yuga, though. There's quite a few... the Hindus do a really great job of outlining and describing and articulating, mainly because they have an unbroken tradition and they did a really good job of record keeping and writing everything down. So let's go through some of the details of the Kali Yuga.
Right. So this is a discourse by Markandeya in the Mahabharata. He identifies some of the attributes of the Kali Yuga. And it says, in relation to rulers, it lists that rulers will become unreasonable. They will levy taxes unfairly. Rulers will no longer see it as their duty to promote spirituality or to protect the subjects. They will become a danger to the world.
Yeah.
People will start migrating, seeking countries where wheat and barley form the staple food source.
The West.
Yeah. At the end of Kali Yuga, when there exists no topics on the subject of God, even at the residences of so-called saints and respectable gentlemen of the three higher varnas, which are the castes, and when nothing is known of the techniques of sacrifice, even by word, at that time the Lord will appear as the supreme chastiser. And the Lord they refer to is the Vishnu in his avatar as Kalki.
Wow. And Kalki's a bad guy, right?
No, Kalki is the avatar of Lord Vishnu, as one of the Trimurti, is the Vaishnavites. They primarily worship him. And he comes to chastise evil and destroy the demon Kali.
Oh, okay, okay. I thought Vishnu comes back as a bad guy.
He comes back as a conquering warlord who basically kills all the unrighteous and just destroys everything except, you know, like, I believe some passages say that he destroys everyone. Like, that's some interpretations, but I believe the more orthodox position is that he only destroys the unrighteous, which is like 99.9% of the people in the Kali Yuga.
Okay. All right, yo, Kalki, leave me be, bub. I'm a good guy.
Right, yeah, you should just remember that he's not bad. Even if he's doing things that might seem bad, it's actually righteous. He's the supreme embodiment of the wrathful righteousness of the gods.
Very cool. And let's go on. What else does it say about Kali Yuga?
Right, it says, with regard to human relationships, Markandeya's discourse says that avarice and wrath will be common. Humans will openly display animosity towards each other, and the ignorance of Dharma will occur. And Dharma is, of course, the bonds of righteousness, the sort of things that everyone should perform and do. Religion, truthfulness, cleanliness, tolerance, mercy, physical strength, and memory diminish with each passing day.
Yeah, very cool.
People will have thoughts of murder with no justification and will see nothing wrong in that. Lust will be viewed as socially acceptable and sexual intercourse will be seen as the central requirement of life. Something we can definitely conceptualize here in modernity.
Absolutely.
Sin will increase exponentially while virtue will fade and cease to flourish. People will become addicted to intoxicating drinks and drugs. Gurus will no longer be respected, and their students will attempt to injure them. Their teachings will be insulted, and followers of Kama will wrest control of the mind from all human beings.
What's that?
And Kama here is the Hindu deity of sex and procreation. So when they say followers of Karma, they mean like they're poetically alluding to people who are licentious, like the whoredom and sexual degenerates, basically.
Yeah. Hard it is on earth with mighty whoredom.
Mm-hmm. All the human beings would declare themselves as gods or boon given by gods and make it as a business instead of teachings. People will no longer get married and live with each other just for sexual pleasure. Weather and environment will degrade with time and frequent and unpredictable rainfalls will happen. Earthquakes will be common. The maximum age of humans will be 50 years by the end of the Kali Yuga. Many fake ideologies will spread throughout the world. The powerful people will dominate the poor people. Many diseases will spread. And finally, at the end of the Kali Yuga, Lord Vishnu will take birth on earth to wipe out the sinners.
That's, they really laid that out there. They didn't leave any stone unturned.
Oh, and it is rather disconcerting to read how many of these parallels seem present in our modern situation.
It's like every single one.
Right, every single one of them, and some of them are just nail on the head.
Yeah, so some of them are just like, it's like word for word. Like the people migrating to places of wheat. Like they're talking about that's the West. That's literally the West. You know, we're like the greatest wheat producers in the world. England, United States, Germany. There's another one, and like are all like top five wheat producers in the world. So that's pretty crazy. So we're at halftime right now, so let's go over to Folkish Farmer, see what he has to say.
Yeah, let's see what kind of delicious stuff he has for us.
Yeah.
Hey guys, welcome to The Folkish Farmer. Obviously today we are not in the kitchen, today I'm in my greenhouse, and unfortunately times have definitely changed, so I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about the coronavirus, what's going on, and you know, what we are doing to prepare. And to be quite honest with you, what I'm doing to prepare for the coronavirus is nothing different than I did last year. I try my best to live a lifestyle that is very similar to our ancestors. I grow a garden. I hunt food. These are my hobbies, as well as they actually procure things for the home and the homestead. And I think this is a great opportunity for people because most people are laid off. They've been furloughed from work. They've been fired, whatever. This is a great opportunity for us all to take some time back and look at what's important in life. And for me, what is super important in life is my family first, obviously, being able to provide for them, whether that be monetarily or through food or through my labor on the land, hunting as well. So the next thing then you want to look at, you know, can I provide, you know, monetary things for my family? And at this time you can't. So it really, this time should be used to be focused in on what is important with your family. And I really hate that, I'm not in the kitchen right now just cooking up something special, because for me right now, a priority is I don't know how long this thing's going to last. I don't know how bad this thing is. I don't really care. My focus now is on the land. And if you read things, especially in our lore, you'll find that our ancestors were quite well prepared. They had to be. Look at the harsh environments that our ancestors came from, whether it be continental Germany, Ireland, Scotland, Iceland, which is even worse, Norway, so on. You didn't have a very extended growing season. I live in Tennessee. I have a great growing season. I've already got plants out in the garden right now. We're actually harvesting some herbs and some plants. So I've actually got a steady supply of greens. And one thing that I think is super important that we can learn from our ancestors is let us utilize some technology like you see here. This is a super cheap greenhouse. I bought this thing at Harbor Freight. I think it cost me $200. Yeah, I had to put some wood in here and, you know, install some support frames for the cheap Chinese garbage that was sent. But the panels are fine. They're no different than a high-end one. This allows me to grow food, and I think our ancestors would have been very proud of the fact that we have this kind of technology. Since a lot of us don't have a lot of time right now to be able to, you know, go out and work and do things like that, let us focus in on our families. Let us focus in on gardening. Learn how to ferment food. Learn how to preserve food. Learn how to grow food. And this is a great opportunity to do that because most people are not doing anything. I had to go out today, unfortunately, into town to take care of some government paperwork. I needed to pick up a title and stuff for my car and some other things. And, you know, people are just out and about, mostly drinking and, having a good time because there's only two or three people in my entire county infected with this thing. So they don't take it seriously. Rather than doing those kind of things, sitting and playing video games or watching Netflix, why not research a little bit on how our ancestors lived? And one of the ways that they lived was through agriculture. And that is kind of the thing that I really want everyone to focus on with this segment is let us look at what we can do in our daily lives that make an impact. Now, speaking about economics, if you grow your own food, every dollar that you spend is a multitude of dollars saved. So, for example, if you're working right now and you have to pay an electric bill, and let's say your electric bill, just make an even number, is $100. The reality is it's $130 to $140 because you've been taxed on that. So when you look at growing food and becoming self-sufficient, you're taking out all the middlemen. You're taking out all of the, you know, interests and banking systems that are involved. It's even better when you and your friends, you know, share seeds, because now there's no cost whatsoever involved. So I really want you guys to focus in on, how do I grow my food? Look at the way your ancestors lived. My great-grandparents, they grew up in the poorest region of the Appalachian Mountains. They said that when the Great Depression came to their town, they had no idea what was going on because they were already so dirt poor. But they lived and they survived. And how did they survive? They knew how to grow their own food. They knew how to trap food. They knew how to kill food. They knew how to slaughter their own animals and everything. These skills are dying out. I work a normal 9-to-5 job like most people. I have a professional career, but I still make time for this. And this is a great opportunity with this coronavirus and a shutdown and everything that's going on to focus in on your family. Focus in. If you've never grown a garden before, it is time to get out and grow a garden. Even if that garden is pitiful and you only get a couple of plants out of it, you learn something. Next year's will be better and the year after will be better. So, we will be back in the kitchen soon preparing nice things. I was going to do a joke, to be quite honest with you, and show you guys like some artistic ways of spam and treat. But I think the real thing is that we need to focus in and take this opportunity and really focus with our families. And one of the most important things that we can do is provide for their nutrition and provide for their well-being. So my suggestion to you guys is, let's all go out this week, because nobody's going to be working next week. I don't care where you're at in the United States, unless you're a delivery guy or, you know, whatever. If you're an essential, then you're working. But if you're like me, you've been basically furloughed and you're non-essential, let us focus in on these gardens and let's share pictures and stuff. I want people to chime in 6 weeks, 8 weeks from now and into the bog and say, hey, guess what, guys? We've got some plants. I want to see these pictures. I want to see people growing various fruits and vegetables and things on their property, because now is the time to become self-sufficient. This corona thing, I'm telling everyone, it will pass. It sucks right now, but it will pass. But the next one will be worse, the next one will be worse, and so on and so forth. Now is the time to prepare, guys, and let's do this together. If you haven't checked out Young Fitness, definitely check that out. No joke, guys, I went from 186 pounds to 172 pounds in 4 weeks. He has got an unbelievable program. If you don't have the room to garden or whatever, contact Jack Young. Get in touch with him on Telegram or on Facebook or whatever. Start talking about getting yourself into shape. I'm doing a lot of work out in the farm and stuff like that, so I am doing a ton of things to get my cardio up and to get in shape. Let's also use this as an opportunity to eat better and to get into shape, and Jack Young can certainly do that. I'm kind of living proof to it. Also, too, guys, I really want everyone to have a good-hearted spirit about this. This is something that should empower our people. We should become stronger through this coronavirus. We're going to become self-sufficient, and we're going to become the society that we want, not what is given to us. And also, guys, have some fun with it. I get accused a lot of times of wearing weird things and stuff like that. I work out in Birkenstocks a lot of times, so I get a lot of slack for that. This is actually what I garden in, so if you guys like it. Unfortunately, my mic fell off there, but it's kilt time, guys. So have fun with this as well. Get out there and garden. And I'll tell you what, a kilt is a great thing to work out in. I'll check you guys later. I am going to be doing some lamb chops. In addition to that, I'm going to be doing some beef shanks as well for the next edition of the Folkish Farmers. So stay tuned for that, and I'll see you guys soon.
All right, my man, Folkish Farmer. I love that guy. He's so great. He's always got so much wisdom. And, man, everybody listen to him, though, man. He's great words, great words. So let's get back into it. We only have a few minutes left. What do you want to do, Tristan? You want to finish off the last couple topics? You want to hit these Q&A, or you want to save Q&A for another time?
Yeah, I want to hit the Shy Bite differences real quick, then we can go to the Q&A.
right.
So there are some differences between the traditional understandings of the end of the Kali Yuga between Vaishnavites, who worship primarily Vishnu, and Shaivites, who worship Shiva as the supreme.
Now, there's more than just that with these two.
Within the sense of the Kali Yuga, of course, they have much greater differences in otherwise.
Because you mentioned the Vaishnavas, right?
Right, the Vaishnavites, yeah.
Yeah, they're like monists. They're sort of monotheists, right?
A lot of them do take the position. There are several orthodox positions you can take within Vaishnavism. Most Hindus are Vaishnavites, I should mention. It's like 75% of them. Then the next greatest denomination are the Shaivites, who worship Shiva as the supreme, and they're like 20%.
And then there's, what are they called?
And then it breaks up into like a much smaller ones, like there's Smarta, and then there's, it just gets much, much smaller after that.
And Shakti?
Right, Shaktiites. And it goes into all the traditions. Some of them I'm not even very familiar with, I can't even talk about here. Primarily all the people that I'm very close to are Shaivites. So that's primary, and that is the one I take. I take the position that it's the closest to the Germanic understanding as well.
And why do you say that? Just because they are the hardest polytheists?
Well, not only that's also a position within there, but also just their positions on the Vedic matters. And, Shiva is cognate to Odin, which we also consider as the king of the gods in our sense. But they also have a sort of what we would call a reputation for being unsavory and a little unorthodox in their methods, which actually, when you're looking at it from our perspective, is mostly just what the Germanic faith does anyway.
Yeah, that's and you said but the Vaishnava, like what Sridharmacharya is, he's like, they're right. Like the majority,
right? The vast majority.
Okay, so let's go into what's the difference between the two as far as their view of the Kali Yuga.
Right. So in the Vaishnavites believe that at the end Vishnu will appear as Kalki to destroy all evil, chaos, and wrongdoers. The Shaivites believe that it's going to be very different. It relates to Shiva, and it's said in this tale that once Parvati asked Lord Shiva, her husband, "You have done good work for the people in all ages, but I am afraid for the people in the Kali Yuga. How will they safeguard themselves?" Then Lord Shiva told Parvati, "I will appear in the Kali Yuga, and I will create a new state, a new center of religion, a most important place where I will live and establish all the gods there."
Now, don't they have a word for that? They call that, what's that, Narayana or something like that?
I'm not familiar with that, actually. I couldn't really tell you if they have a word for it, but I imagine they do.
Yeah, I believe they have, there's like an entire concept around it, but maybe we'll get some Hindus on here to talk about that sometime.
Right. And even here, that's what I was saying about how the Shaivites appear more similar to the Germanic faith, that one of the gods appearing into create a great center of religion and a city where all the other gods will come sounds much more Germanic, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And is the god supposed to come in like the form of a great king, right?
Yeah, Shiva would definitely come, and he established it as the state. Assumedly, he would also be the king there.
Yeah. And Folks Farmer donates another Ninjini money bags tonight. I love seeing the Ninjini for this show. Roy Danton, great show, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. So here we have, we can go on down to the Q&A section to get everyone's answered. So the first one here is from Carl Carlson, who says, "I've read all the Asatru 101 type books as well as the Eddas, and I'm starting on the Icelandic sagas. I'm doing this as a solitary activity for now. So what's next to move on to the next level?"
Oh, yeah, wait, I missed. Roy Danton had another Ninjini. Says, "Awesome stuff, very inspiring." Thanks, guys. Sorry. I'm getting all pumped up about these Ninjinis.
Yeah, I mean, it can be difficult to make sure we're viewing everything and still reading our notes and whatever. So if we ever miss anything, just be sure to ping us on the chat or something. We'll definitely get to it.
Absolutely.
So would you like me to read the Q&A, or did you get that?
How much time we got left? We have 9 minutes.
Oh, no. I had already started it. So I was saying, did you hear me say the first one, or would you like me to repeat it?
Oh, yeah, repeat it for me. Sorry, I was distracted by Ninjinis.
Right, it was Carl Carlson, and he asks, I've read all the Asatru 101 type books as well as the Eddas, and I'm starting on the Icelandic sagas. I'm doing this as a solitary activity for now, so what's next to move on to the next level? Thank you guys, have a great day.
Many hails to you, Carl Carlson. He's read all the 101 Asatru books and all of the Eddas, and he's starting on the sagas, and he wants to know, well, he's doing this solitary for now. And that's usually the step that most people take. What's next to move on to the next level? Well, I want to clarify. I'm not sure if he means as far as reading material or if he means as far as practice. You know, obviously reading material, I'm going to say Otis book is a must read. As well as, I'm sure, you know, Tristan's going to echo this. Culture of the Teutons is a great read. Great read, actually. Tacitus Germania is a great. These are kind of more historical understandings, but it helps to develop your world or your ancestral worldview. There's a few others. Lady in the Mead Cup's a pretty good one. Some people recommend Seeds of Yggdrasil. A more abstract one is the Masks of Odin. I didn't finish that one. I'm trying to think off the top of my head if there's more reading material. Epicis Magazine's great. Nature of Asatru by Mark Pereira's great. Most of the Nerona Society, Odin's Wife by William Reeves is a tremendous read. As far as reading material, those are that's like the next step. We unfortunately, as far as like deep philosophy, there's not a whole lot of writing, especially outside of, you know, I'm not trying to say this to sound arrogant or anything, outside of Nerona Society, there's not a whole lot as far as real deep philosophy and stuff like that. But as far as your next step as a practitioner, you got to get out and bloat, man. You got to get out. You got to get to an event. Doesn't matter if it's you're going AFA or Dinnick Wright or whatever you want to do, or if you want to go find just a local unaffiliated kindred. What matters is that you join the real life community, or if you start a kindred, start a clan, start a tribe, whatever you want to call it, and you perform bloat. Your exoteric community rituals are what complete you. That is what is the next step. If you are, go ahead.
The faith is absolutely a communal faith. If you're not performing the bloat, you're not giving prayers to the gods, you're not a practicing member of the religion.
Not yet. And, you know, it's there's like a year, a whole year of study and contemplation before people are confident enough to do that. You know what I mean? So that's nothing against people that are still in kind of like that solitary, still learning phase. That's a beautiful time, and that's an important time. That's a phase you got to go through. But the next step of evolution, after you're done with your reading and your contemplation and your studying and your confidence, say, this is who I am. The next step is getting out into the community and getting out and practicing and performing and doing your exoteric practices.
Right, I would agree 100%. So on to the next question. Unlocking Your Energy says, can you give some of us newcomers a background on your lives? What religions did you come from? Are you originally from New York, etc.? Why don't you start with that one, Dave?
Oh, well, I'm guessing he asked if I'm originally from New York. That's aimed at me because I'm the Northeast guy. I am not from New York. I've only been to New York a handful of times. I'm actually from Pennsylvania. I'm from rural Pennsylvania. I've lived on the East Coast, multiple different places. I grew up around the I-95 corridor. You know, I'm from rural central PA, and a lot of people guess by my accent. They say, oh, if you're like from the South or you're from the West or something like that, you hear my accent and you think, oh, well, you know, he's a New Yorker. I'm not a New Yorker. I am, you know, broadly Rust Belt kind of Pennsylvania Dutch. I guess our accents are kind of Philly sounding, but anyway, my background is my family is half-assed Roman Catholic. I grew up half-assed Roman Catholic until I was, but my whole life I've always been enamored and in love with the myth, and I deep down always had a belief in it. And I actually told this story on an episode of God's Folk and Destiny that I used to produce for Mr. Stephen McNallan. Or maybe it was Ragnarok and Roll. I can't remember. I used to produce both Mr. McNallan's shows. You know, much love to Mr. McNallan, by the way, if he's ever tuning in to me. So I mentioned this even during my time as an atheist, because it was like I've always been in love with the myths. And even I remember being like a teenager and stuff and saying like, hey guys, like tell my friends, I believe in the Norse gods. I believe in the Germanic gods. And they're like, all right, like the time being a teenager, you don't really believe in anything devoted. You're not devoted to anything. You're just kind of drinking beer and goofing off and playing guitar and shooting guns and wrestling your buddies and, you know, doing all that stuff. Well, you know, I never knew that people practiced. You know, I mean, I just thought it was like everybody thinks this is just something that is lost in the pages of history. When I got a little bit older, I kind of pretended to be. Well, also, here's another thing. The first time I ever prayed, I prayed to Thor. That was the first time I ever actually prayed. And it was the biggest tornado ever recorded in the history of Pennsylvania. Touched down the field behind my house, and I saw it. And it was turned the sky black. I can't remember if it was an F3 or an F4 or something like that. It doesn't matter. The thing was gargantuan. It was huge. It was like this giant black pillar of Mother Nature, and it stretched all the way up to the sky, and you couldn't hear anything. It sounded like a train going past, like a freight train going past your face. It's apocalyptic if you've ever seen a tornado. But in PA, we don't get tornadoes. We barely get like storms. Like it's, you know, so it was like earth-shattering for us. And I saw this thing, and it touched down in the field. And I just got all of my family into the basement, and I ran up to go get my dog to save my dog. And I see the black funnel. And the first thing that I said was, I prayed to Thor. I said, Thor, please protect my family. And guess what? The tornado jumped over my house and landed in the development down the road, ripped a tree, an oak tree that was like 3 feet wide, ripped it out of the ground, broke it in half, hucked it, you know, hundreds of feet, landed in the development, flattened the development, destroyed hundreds of houses, and me and my neighbors were all safe. It jumped over our house, which is a common thing, but I believe in my heart that Thor saved me that day. And that stuck with me forever. That was the first proof of divine in my life that I have experienced. And I remember, like, days after it happened, my friends came over to help clean up my yard and stuff, like, because it was a mess. My friend Andrew, who rest in peace, he passed away a few years ago of a drug overdose. But he came up to me and said, I didn't say anything. He said, he's like, dude, Thor saved you. And I was like, it's one of them feelings that it's just like too many coincidences, too much weird stuff. And you get that feeling in your body, like that weird, like tingly, you just kind of get a chill. And I was like, and I said to him, I was like, he did. He saved my family. And that was the first time I ever prayed. And, you know, whether or not Thor actually did that or if it was a coincidence, I can't prove it. But that's what I believe in my heart. And from then on, I was still, I still had that feeling. And then later on, as a young man, I became an atheist because the atheist movement was just starting. And, like, I was, you know, a Christian reactionary during this time. And I didn't know that people actually practiced. And I remember one thing particular that rubbed me wrong about atheism. I watched an interview, I believe it was Richard Dawkins. And Richard Dawkins had his one of his canned responses, which now as somebody has a deeper understanding of religion, I look back and I see what a doofus Richard Dawkins is. You know, his genetic research and his genetic work is obviously brilliant, but his work into like religion and stuff like
is I always so say that he's probably the greatest geneticist and biologist that we have in modern day. So not knock him on that, but the man is not a good philosopher.
No, his understanding of religion is ham-fisted at best. It is bad. But anyway, he said something in an interview that I always remembered, and it kind of put a bad taste in my mouth about atheism. And what he said in this interview was something along those, like one of his canned responses. I'm sure everybody's heard it. He says, "You believe in one God. You believe in one less God than I do. I'm just, you know, further on the spectrum of atheism. I just think that all gods, you know." And then he starts naming gods. He says Apollo, Vishnu, and then he mentions like all these gods. And he says, "And Thor are equally ridiculous." And the fact that he mentioned Thor as ridiculous, even in my period of atheism, it pissed me off. I didn't like it. It rubbed me wrong. And from that point on, and I wasn't even practicing or anything at this point. I had that echo of love for the Germanic gods in my mind, in the back of my mind. And that put a bad taste in my mouth. From that point on, I started to dislike atheism. And then I found my way.
Suddenly it got real for you.
Yeah. So I know my story's going on real long. But so anyway, long story short, I started to find out that people practice. I picked up a few books and I started reading and I started watching videos by Mr. Stephen McNallan. And he was like early days of YouTube. And he used to do these videos where he sits in front of a fireplace, and he's got the blue AFA polo on, and he's got his white beard, and he's holding his horn, and he says, "What is also true?" And he does this whole thing. He talks like Gandalf and everything. But that was my introduction, and that's I never look back.
Right, and for me personally, I spent the vast majority of my early life in Appalachia, in North Carolina specifically, up in the mountains there. Not that far, actually, from where Focus Farmer lives. I lived there until I was about 13 or so, and I moved to Hawaii in the Big Island, where I lived for the rest of my teenage years. And I actually have a rather unique religious background in that I was never a Christian or anything of the sort. My father raised me in the faith. He is also like us. He raised me to be very cognizant of my ancestry and my background and the gods and what it means to us as a people. You know, my father's a very intelligent sort of person. We talk about philosophy and history and the history of our ancestors. You know, my patrilineal line comes from Iceland. So, in fact, many of my ancestors are, in fact, inscribed in the Icelandic sagas. You can read about my ancestor who literally did this and this back then. So it was always something that was very prominent for me personally growing up, and it's probably the greatest fulcrum point of my life. And that probably explains why I'm so interested in it now and so invested and well-read on the topic. I've been doing it for my entire life.
Now, in our live chat here, we're going over time, but I don't even care. I like answering questions for people. In the chat real quick, MDOS is mentioning about so here's his question, I believe. In the South, in Shiva in the East, do you think there was a Proto-Indo-European deity that merged with the Germanic Sky Father and or Vedic Sky Father? And he's mentioning, I believe he's referring to the Tiwaz stuff. He says, so in the South and Shiva in the East, do you think there was a Proto-Indo-European deity that merged with the Germanic Sky Father and or Vedic Sky Father?
No, I take the position that Odin is in fact the Sky Father, and this is all a single deity. From Odin to Deus Pater to Shiva, this is all the same deity. I don't believe in the theory in which Tiwaz was originally the leader of the pantheon, and I believe that that theory is basically composed of an etymological root in which Tiwaz is cognate to Deus Pater, but Tiwaz is not actually the deity's name. It's just a title, just like Odin is also called Hangaguth or Hangatir. It's composed. It means in the Nordic period, it just meant to refer to a god, one of the brave.
Now he says, okay, so I missed his first couple things. He says, the Indo-European striker storm deity combined with the Sky Father and the Greco-Roman world to form Zeus and Jupiter. This did not occur in the North. However, unlike the Greco-Roman Sky Fathers, Odin is a madness shamanic deity similar to Dionysus.
Oh, that is very much the case, and I have quite a lot of research on the cognates between Odin, Dionysus, and Shiva. One of the things is, even if you look at Dionysus, Nisos, I believe it's called, is the mountain in which he was born. Dio means god. He is literally the god of the mountain. But one of his other epithets was the god of the tree, which it forms a sort of middle ground here, because in the North we have the Axis Mundi as the great tree Yggdrasil, whereas in the Indian tradition they have the mountain in which Shiva resides on. I can't remember the name at the moment. It's just slipping my mind. But so Dionysus sort of forms a hypostasis between these positions, in which he is both god of the mountain and god of the tree, because fundamentally the tree and the mountain are both the exact same poetic allusion to the Axis Mundi.
Yeah.
But yes, in the Greek period, you see, people always use the Greeks as a sort of baseline foundation for what we should think about Indo-Europeans, because everyone's so familiar with the Greek and classical mythology. But actually, these people were very syncretic with other Near Eastern paganisms that are Semitic and just not Babylonian, not related to the Indo-European people. And they confused and conflated it with a bunch of their own indigenous beliefs. They had storm kings, and they were great warriors and slew a dragon. I mean, that's sort of stuff. And they sort of conflated the Thunderstriker as Thor, Perkwunos, into the myth of the Sky Father, whereas in the Nordic tradition, it didn't happen.
That's another thing people got to keep in mind is in the North, they didn't have contact with just about anybody besides like the Mediterraneans later on. The Greeks had interactions and accepted contamination from many, many of their neighbors who were not Indo-European. You know, who was it? The Scythians. Well, the Scythians were Indo-European. But you have, like, they talk about the Sea People. The Sea People were absolutely a Semitic peoples. You had interactions with the Mesopotamians. You had interactions with, this is Rome, but they had interactions with Carthage. So both of the...
Even in the Greek period, they were the Phoenicians. That's basically Phoenicians. The continuation of Carthage.
Yeah, the Phoenicians. So the Phoenicians, which are, you know, the Canaanites... you had so there's quite
Egypt as well.
Yeah, that's the biggest one that we're forgetting is Egypt.
Right.
Yeah. So
all along the Libyans in North Africa. I mean, there's a bunch of these tribes that aren't Indo-Europeans, and they were having trade and connections into Greece that ended up eventually just mutating. Plus, also we have to remember that in Greece specifically, the replacement of the indigenous Europeans with the Indo-European peoples that came and conquered the land was not as total as other places. They actually have a very significant paternal lineage in Greece of indigenous Europeans. It just wasn't a full cultural replacement, and a lot of the indigenous practices probably survived.
Yeah, and in fact, the highest percentage of Neolithic farmer DNA is found in Sardinia. A lot of people don't know that. But he says, you know, MDoS says, Dionysus, like proto-Indo-European deity merging with Odin, not Tyr. Yeah, and he donates a diamond. Thank you, MDoS. So pretty much
I wouldn't say that Dionysus merged with Odin. I take the position that these are just
Odin
the same
older.
Deity.
Odin right. is old. Odin is older than Zeus, more authentic.
You know, actually, it goes to the position that Dionysus is actually just a cover name for Hades, which is actually a position that part of some of the mysteries in Greece at the time did held. You know, it is a legitimate belief. It's not just me theorizing it, that Hades and Dionysus are the same deity. It's just when Hades went up into the ground and came out of his underworld, he called himself Dionysus because he wasn't supposed to be out there, so he kind of created like an avatar figure for himself.
Yeah, that's really fast. I never heard that one before, but
it's fascinating. I have an entire work about it, connecting with Odin and whatnot. I'll have to turn it into like an actual article at some point.
Yeah, maybe episode 3.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll see. So, long story short with this, what we're saying is that it's not good to use the Greco, you know, no offense to the Hellenismos. I have friends that are Hellenismos or Religio Romano. You know, loved you guys. So, no, take no offense, but this is just is my position. The Greco-Roman traditions have more contaminants, are not as authentically Indo-European as the Germanic. If you want to look at what probably the mother root Indo-European tradition is in the West, it is the Germanic pantheon.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm very upfront with my belief that if there's two religions in the world that maintain the most connection to the original Indo-European beliefs, it's the Germanic faith and the Vedic faith.
And I'm actually going to bring them on here, but... I mentioned him earlier because some of his theories, one novitiates in my kindred believes that that the Germanic tradition is actually the oldest of the Indo-European traditions. And he believes that the Aryan invasion started in Denmark and then moved out into the steppe, and he's got archaeological evidence, and he's got a pretty good argument to support it. So
right, he did. He hit me up with that, and we talked about it a bit. So it would be interesting to have him on. We could discuss it.
Yeah, so that's a really, and it flies in the face of modern theory, and I hope he writes something up. But anyway, let's go to the next question.
Right, the next one we have here is from our friend at Aryakasha, Shruya Nagala, who says, "What exactly does Sethian mean, and also who are your patron deities?"
Sethianism means, it comes from the word foreign sed, which means like the old customs, the old traditions. And what Sethian means is just means the custom, the tradition. So we are of the custom.
Well, specifically when we were talking about Sethian as a title, as a religious element, what we mean here is that we take a reconstructionist view of our works and the religion, and believe that it is in fact a religion with an actual text and a sacred sphere and a sacred text that we can look back and we can see an orthodoxy to it. To say that you're a Sethian Asatru or Odinist or whatever is basically to say that you acknowledge that the sacred texts are a real text, and you acknowledge that the deities are real deities. It's an actual religion. It's not just a metaphor, and that we wish to have a reconstructionist standpoint towards the faith of our forefathers.
Yes, it is. We take the stance that we have hierology, we have sacred texts, we have coherent foundations, we have philosophical foundations, we have an entire framework of eschatology, of cosmology, and of epistemology. And we are a big boy religion. We are a big boy religion with big boy rules, big boy ideas, and we very much believe this is a living tradition with living philosophy that will continue to expand and stuff like that. I don't reject the term reconstructionist. It's just when I think of reconstructionists, I think about guys that wear tunics and stuff. I think about, theodism and stuff like, which theodism, you know, I mean, nothing against it. There's so much great work came out of theodism, but that's not who we are. So,
right. And, you know, I mean, even specifically about dressing up in tunics and stuff, it can look, you know, kind of goofy and whatnot. But personally, I've always taken the standpoint that, it's not out of the ordinary for a priest to dress differently than the rest of the people around him, even to dress in an almost a medieval fashion. I mean, if you look at a bishop or a Roman Catholic priest or an Orthodox priest, they do in fact dress exactly like they would have in the medieval period. And even that is just a continuation from how the Roman senators dressed.
Yeah, and actually, speaking of sacred dress, we are developing, sacred garb for our rituals and stuff like that. It's, you know, I very much do like AFA. They dress very nice and they wear their suits and they wear modern stuff, and I support that completely. But our priest class wears sacred garments. And this is, you're going to see when we start putting out videos of bloats and events and stuff like that, you're going to see, I mean, it's going to develop over time. You're going to start seeing guys wearing like beautiful vestments with gold buttons. And, you know, we're into it. You know what I mean? We're not just out there wearing t-shirts and stuff. It's pretty sacred stuff. So, and I believe the other question was, what are our patron deities? The Aesir gods.
Oh, no, he means specifically, like, do you have a specific deity that you worship more than the others, like Odin or Tyr or Thor?
For me, my patron deity is the All-Mother Frigg. And then after that is probably, Thor, just because, you know, he saved my life. All-Mother Frigg gave me beautiful children and a healthy family, and Thor saved my life, and those are the two that I kind of pray to the most. When I pray to the Frigg, I call her Hola, because that's kind of like the Alpine name and stuff like that. But, you know, Frigg, Hola, it's all interchangeable to me. I'm a pan-Germanicist. I don't view there's like a difference between Odin and Woden and Votan. They're all the same deities.
Yeah, I personally don't have a patron deity in a specific sense, though I do tend to favor the worship of Freyr, Odin, and Freya more than of the other deities. Out of, I mean, it's just their connections relating to my own heritage here, and also my own personal predilections, I suppose. You know, I feel their spheres more connect to me more deeply. It's what I would wish to emulate, and I just feel a greater connection towards these. But I don't worship one deity particularly more than the others.
Yeah, I believe that's called henotheism or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you can worship a patron deity, and it is, in fact, a legitimate form. Like, our ancestors did have patron deities, but if you're worshiping one deity in a monotheistic fashion, or even a henotheistic fashion, I would say that this is not legitimate or what our ancestors did.
Sure, yeah. But I have prayed to all of the gods. You know, I mean, I honor different gods,
absolutely,
different days, and so it's not like I ignore other deities, but I very much, you know, speaking of heritage, my father is of Alpine descent, and my mother is Italian. So the Lombards, they worshipped Frigg. That was their girl. And the Alpine people worshipped Frahola. That was their girl. So both sides of my family, Frigg was present. So it does have a very much ancestral thing as well. And my family, my father's family, has been in the Pennsylvania colony since the 1580s for a long, long time. And, my kindred is called Penfolk. We are to join my kindred, you have to be a resident of Pennsylvania. You have to be born Pennsylvanian, or you have to be married to somebody that is born Pennsylvanian. So we have a lot of emphasis on our regional heritage as well. And as I said before, a lot of the Germanic peoples, they pray. And if you look at the Pennsylvania Dutch heathenry, which is called Erglave, they worship Frahola above all else. So that is it's a really interesting. That's a really interesting tradition as well. So that's that. What's the next question we got?
The next question is from Windham, and he says, opinions on Arith Hager. He's very much left-hand path, but his videos are very interesting.
I completely reject Arith Hager, and I'm going to tell you why. And this is going to start drama, but I don't care because he's a scumbag. So Arith has been caught twice plagiarizing the Nirona Society, both times William Reeves. He has plagiarized William Reeves, probably more that we haven't caught. But he is an e-celeb. He is a content vulture. He is inconsistent with his beliefs. He is out there for shekels. And the first time he got busted plagiarizing William Reeves and the Nirona Society, he got called out. And as in retaliation, he did a very half-assed smear piece fake review of the Ars Druida. And he continued to plagiarize. So Arith Hager is not a good guy. He's not a good guy, and he's a plagiarist.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really familiar with him whatsoever, except for the drama around William and his book. But yeah, from all accounts, it sounds like he's probably one of these fake heathen, Satanist, occultic types who like to infiltrate the movement.
Yeah, that's exactly what he is. He promotes ideas like Rockatru.
Absolutely. Nothing to do with him. No.
He's I highly suggest against watching him or paying attention to him, and I have nothing good to say about him.
Right. Going on to the question by Eric Smith, and he says, I found the Nirona Society's take on Tyr versus Baldur and Forseti for the god of justice, as much as their gods can be gods of one thing anyway, compelling. Same with the recent video talking about Jord, Frigg, and all the Fraunhalla parallels. Mm-hmm. Are there any other gods or goddesses that got a similar redesignation after looking into them more deeply? If so, could you provide examples?
So, I'm not a guy that can recite lore off the top of my head, but I can tell you one of them is Hel, the goddess Hel, is not a goddess, and that it is actually Urd. That is the big one.
Yeah, my big one, I keep harping on everyone because it's, you know, like I've said in the earlier question about patron deities, I worship Freyr quite frequently. Freyr is very different than most heathens have previously understood him as. He's not a deity of he's not like a female Demeter. He's not some crop deity where they do fields, and he's not male Aphrodite. He's not a god of love and sex and that kind of thing. Freyr is fundamentally a god of kingship. He's a god of Hamingja, of Frith. He rules over the countryside, and he gives everyone good harvest because of his great luck and his connection to the kingly royal house of Sweden.
Yeah.
He's not a peaceful deity. His horse is called Bloody Hooved. He rides the battle boar, he leads the people. He judges over others as a priest. I mean, this is what his role, his designation was. It's very much that of a noble. He was the paramount noble in Nordic society, which is very, as you can imagine, very different than most people understand him as.
Very cool. So, that's all I got off the top of my head. We'll do a whole show about it sometime. How about that, Mr. Eric Smith?
Right, and our friend Jack Young says, can you clear up post-mortem notions? Uh-huh. Do people reincarnate after a certain period of time in the afterlife, like Ragnarok, or do they stay in the afterlife forever, whilst another part of their soul reincarnates?
This is a really great question. So this is a debate, actually, that goes on in not just Setianism, but in all of proper heathenry that are also true. People believe in afterlife and eschatology, which they should, because it's a real religion, not just some LARP. But so this is the debate: that do you go to the afterlife and you stay there and get reincarnated after, like, a, is it cataclysmic reincarnation, or is it like an immediate systematic reincarnation, kind of like what the Hindus believe, and what kind of gets talked about in an area of science called parapsychology. So here's the where it kind of gets, this is the debate. So there are parts in the lore where it talks about how, like, for example, actually, Mr. Reeves, speaking of William Reeves, he was just talking about this earlier in one of our chats. He said, and this is something that's in the lore, that in the lore it talks about if you go to hell, when you go to Helheim and you travel, and you unfortunately, if you go to Niflhel, you suffer what's called a second death. And what happens is you shed your kind of like human form, and you take on a kind of like a mutated form. And what it's described as is the souls fly around looking like burnt eagles or something like that. And what that's kind of describing is, like, you look like just like a featherless, weird ghost creature flying around because you've lost your form completely. A lot of people also interpret this as you suffer a second death, as in you are completely obliterated if you go to Niflhel. So, and now as far as the people that don't go to Niflhel, the bad place, so to speak, there's a debate around whether or not you are called from the afterlife to be reincarnated now, or if you just stay there and you wait until Ragnarok, where you repopulate the earth. So I don't know what Tristan's position is. My position is both, probably.
Yeah, I have a very complex and nuanced take on the position that we could actually run an entire thing on. So, as I've mentioned before on the stream, that I believe the soul is composed of five different parts that are like sub-souls. You know, it's the Hamr, the Hugr, the Munr, the Fylgja, and the Hamingja. Well, when you die, some parts of you are not, like we talk about all the time, that the individual doesn't really exist. We're a combination in our souls of an individual person, entities that were related to the clan, and memories and emotions and all these other things that are separate and break up from each other. So when you die, what happens is all of your things go down to the Helting, where you're judged, and from there you proceed to either Niflheim, where you are punished, eaten, or ripped apart, or you proceed to one of the destinations of the afterlife, which could be Valhalla, could be one of the halls of the other gods, or mm-hmm. It just depends on what, the circumstances of your life and death. But there, that your souls are going to end up eventually breaking apart into at least two components that are probably the Hugr and the Munr here. So, and I can't really say which is which, that which one gets reincarnated. I think the Mooner is the one that gets reincarnated. That eventually, after time, you know, like maybe one of your descendants is born after so much amount of time, your Mooner will separate and reincarnate down your family line. So you specifically as an individual and what makes you an individual person will stay in the afterlife of wherever you end up. But also there's an aspect of your soul that contains the essence of your being will also reincarnate eventually inside one of the members of your kin. So when you have to understand this, when we talk about the topic here, we have to fundamentally understand that the individual is an illusion of our time on Earth reincarnated into a mortal body. Once we die and become more spiritual entities in the halls of the gods, this doesn't quite work that way.
Yeah, that's a great take. You know, it's hopefully we figure this out for sure soon because there's a lot of debate and a lot of different interpretations and stuff like that. So let's go to the next question here.
Right. We have this one from Fashu Baitso. He says, what happens to someone who dies from a drug overdose? Where do they go? Let's say they have battled addiction for years and strive to be better, but the grips of their disease led them down a dark and grim lane in life. Mm-hmm. Heart is pure, but for some reason the will becomes weak. And be real about it, though. Well, he or she must be weak, so fuck them, not it's nonsense.
Yeah.
If you have friends or family who have suffered from addiction, odds are you know a few who are outstanding men or women, but for some reason they faltered. What becomes of them? Is there a purgatory, a lesser plane of eternal? And what way should we as a folk fight this fight? Thanks.
All right, well, Fashy Whiteso, you know, I know this firsthand, man. I mean, being an older millennial, growing up in the Rust Belt, growing up in rural PA, I've lost a lot of friends. Man, one of my friends, my best friend in the whole world, he died from a drug overdose a few years ago. I miss him. I think about him every single day. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And they're weak. So, you know, F them thing is, yeah, no, I don't just agree that it's nonsense, but I would say that is a disgusting idea to think that your loved ones that suffered from this ailment are so weak. So they're going on. The might is right is not a position our ancestors had. Our ancestors, we know that they made instruments for people to be able to walk. You know what I mean? They cared for the weak and the lame. They cared for the old. They cared about each other. It wasn't, you know, the strongest and the strongest survive and crush the weak. And they didn't think like that. If you were within the tribe, they had love for you. You know, and so that I completely agree, and that's kind of off the tangent, but where they go, you know, if they have not committed great nith, if they have not committed great sin, then they will go to the Hall of the Ancestors. That's it. You know, it's not like, you know, if you do drugs, they might go to a place to get cleaned out before the cycle begins, but... You know, unless during their drug addiction, unless they like raped somebody or killed a bunch of kids or did something really, really despicable, in my mind, they are going to go to the Hall of the Ancestors and get reborn.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually echo that there are only there are very few and very specific crimes that are specifically called Neath. And it doesn't entirely line up with today what we would think of as abominable moral decisions. Some of these are the breaking of oaths is considered Neath. So is to adultery if you seduce another member of your kindred or, you know, like break up your friend's family, you seduce their wife, this is Neath. Or to murder someone against, you know, like secret in the dark, stab them in the back, they're your friend. That is also considered Neath. But other than these, you know, these sorts of things, you pretty much, you don't suffer the fate of anything, and you're judged either to reside in Helheim amongst the ancestors, most of the people, or there are possible afterlives amongst the halls of the gods, which we don't have very much, I'll be real, we don't have information on how you get into the halls of the gods. Other than maybe they accept you into there, maybe it's your patron deity, we just don't know. Yeah. But presumably you're judged at the Hell King, and if you're not anything, you go on to one of the different afterlives. In fact, I almost misspoke here because we do understand that Thor's Hall is where he protects and keeps all the thralls. So that's one destination that we know specifically is for the Halls of the Gods. We could might be able to say that maybe like a drug addicted person is kind of like a thrall who needs protection. But I mean, that's not really a great one-on-one equivalence. I'm not sure I'd really go with that.
So, they don't, there is no like purgatory unless you commit great sin, great nith, you go to the Hall of the Ancestors. It's not, you know, it's not like that.
Which doesn't mean the ancestors will be pleased to see you. You might very well have to take some beatings.
Yeah. But you will be reborn and you will get a chance to, you know, try again. So I wanted to read one from my buddy Tom Lewis. He says, Tristan, you are very knowledgeable, sir, and much smarter than me. Dave, I miss the car talks, man. I need the average heathen's point of view more. Maybe Tristan breaking down his knowledge and you simplifying it to us everyday working men into understandable bites. Much love from a longtime listener. Hail Frigga. Hail to you, my friend. I appreciate the compliment.
I do, in fact, appreciate the compliment. Thank you.
All right, so what else we got? Let's do them all. We're already over time. Let's keep going.
Oh, yeah, I don't actually have them pulled up now. Do you have them?
Yeah, so let me find
it. Yeah, just give me the next one.
So here's a good one from White Healing. We see him a lot as our buddy. I'm mostly Irish, oh wise ones. Should I look into Celtic native religion or is the Germanic native religion? I get that Ossetru is literally or effectively true to the gods, but there seems to be difference.
Yeah, and I actually recently was advising someone about this, so I mean, I do have a very good position on it. I take the position that you should go with the gods of your own ancestors, and if you're Irish, you're Celtic, you should probably be worshipping the Celtic deities instead of the Norse ones. Though I am very sympathetic to the fact that Celtic paganism, I mean, effectively doesn't exist in the same form that you know, the Norse Germanic variety does. I mean, it's full of Wiccans and LARPers and druids shaking like crystal staffs at people, right? And that's very disheartening. Yeah. And they're, Celtic paganism in general doesn't have the same reconstructive ability as the Germanic sources do because there's just not that many sources and they're not as good. So I can understand why people would want to just jump to the Germanic as basically the closest to equivalency. But, I mean, I do have to say that ideally, you should be worshiping the Celtic deities, and it's kind of awkward if we're talking about our ancestors and like your ancestors aren't fucking my ancestors, right?
That is if indeed the Celtic peoples were a different people than the Germanics.
Well, I mean, I definitely would take the position that they are definitely a different people, at least in a cultural group.
According
I would
to
say
the Romans,
that a bit. If we go back far enough, they were a similar people. They come from the same origin group and the Indo-European peoples, of course. But there are religious and cultural differences amongst them and genetic differences even.
So now there was Survive the Jive talked about this when he was on the episode with us about the differences between the Irish and the Germanics. It is not that much. They had similar societal structure. They had an order of priests. They had bloats. They had, it was very, very, very similar. So what I'm seeing a lot of and what these guys are calling themselves is, I forget, they have a word for it, but Daru or something like that. But they're like folkish Irish. And what a lot of these guys are doing that I've talked to is they're essentially discovering which cognates to the Germanic gods in the pantheon are surviving from the Irish, and they pretty much plug them into our spiritual and ritualistic framework. So they are essentially doing bloats and observing similar holidays, but they're using Irish terminology and Irish pantheon.
Yeah, and you know what? If you combine that with the actual reconstructive sources we have, I would be completely supportive of that. And it's not too dissimilar from the same relationship I would use Hinduism for when we reconstruct Germanic texts and sources and whatnot. You know, you're just looking at the one that's just more complete and more connected and everything. And, you know, you have to reconstruct it from that, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, if you are full blood Irish and you really feel Irish, and you have that resonates with you, and you go with it, go with it. So, what else do we got here?
Yeah, hit me with another one.
For my boy Seth, this is my buddy here. Is it wrong to think we could ever communicate or see the gods as described in the lore?
No, whatsoever. We would, in fact, communicate and see the gods, and I personally believe that I have done so.
Same. I couldn't even. I don't even have anything to add to that. I just agree completely. So, Vlad the Improper says, "Are there any specific prayers or protection found anywhere in the lore?"
We could go with that one prayer you like to do, huh, Dave?
The prayer that I use is not so much like a guardian angel prayer or anything like that, but is the opening prayer I use for my bloats. And what it does is it invites the divine and the ancestors to come consecrate the ground. And what consecration does is it kind of creates a sacred space, an area that is purified with with divinity. You are making it holy. You are making it whole. And when you make an area holy, it is an area of protection. So the prayer is, and it's not found in the lore, but it's a prayer that is passed down and what a lot of people use. And I think it's found in a saga somewhere. I think that's where people are. But I'm not an expert on the sagas. But long story short, the prayer is you invoke the both tribes of the gods, and you invoke the Allfather and the Deesir, and you say, Helga ve theta o kindra ala ilska. What that means is, come bless this sacred space. That's what that means. And if you do that, and you do that in your area, this area will be protected by the gods. I lived in a when I first learned this prayer. Actually, my house now has some. There's some dark energies here. Sometimes I think that it could be partially haunted. I've performed that prayer in most of my house. Not like, you know, in the areas that I think that there are some of this darkness at, but the areas that I sleep, I don't have any sort of problems. And so I believe that it is a prayer of protection.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like probably the most predominant prayer we have in the lore, which actually I'd have to say is lacking in a lot of the direct attestations for prayers and whatnot. So we do have a couple. We do have a couple examples, and you know, you can find them. We'll have to talk about it sometime.
Yeah, Hail the Day is another prayer. There's a few. So we could actually get into it. Let's do an episode about prayer.
Also, there is in fact the sign of the hammer, which is recorded in a saga to cause blessings from Thor. He hollows the ground. So it's a very good one to use.
Yep. Yep, and a lot of people say, "Oh, well, that's just Christian, propaganda. Blah, blah, blah. That's just copying the Christian sign of the cross." Not at all. Not even close.
No, direct attestation in a saga. I mean, you can't get better than that.
What is it? Harkon the Good. Or
it is
like that?
The saga of Harkon the Good.
So yeah, that's that. What else we got here? What folk metal bands do you like?
Oh, folk metal, huh? I listen to LOVT a lot. I listen to, Tier isn't really folk metal. They have some folkish elements. I like them quite a bit. I actually am more of a straight up just Viking metal kind of guy. I quite like the band Rebellion. They have probably my favorite metal band in general.
Yeah, what are they called? I really like them. They got the two guy singers. They're not their newer stuff. They're old stuff. They had a song called Nehalania. That was like their most popular song. I can't remember.
I'm not sure I know them.
Yeah. Forwards, forwards, over the saying. They sing in Dutch. I can't remember what they're called. They're really good. People will be able to find them. As far as folk metal, Finn Troll had a couple good songs. I like I don't really listen to a whole lot of folk metal. I like some of it, but I like I prefer more, like, I guess you could say neo-folk. Like Fawn is good. Obviously, everybody likes Wardruna. Some of, what are they called? They're pretty popular. They do. They have like the really primitivist kind of stage production.
You know what? This isn't the answer to what you're saying, but one of the ones I do quite like is Falkenbach.
Yeah,
I do listen to him quite good. There is also, I mean, it says here Tiresias is considered folk metal. I wouldn't really normally consider that, but I listen to them quite often. And also Insifrum is very good.
Oh, yeah, Insifrum's great. They're great.
Yeah.
One more magic potion. I love those guys. They're great.
See, I like the Wanderer is my favorite.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is folk metal, but... I'm so out of it with metal bands. They had the Winter Sun. Winter Sun's great. I guess they're more melodic metal. I don't know. Obviously, the early Amon Amarth albums. Everybody likes that. They're kind of like Amon Amarth for heathens is like AC/DC at this point. Yeah, it's like
But I mean, if you want to talk about, you know, metal bands, when we're talking about really with religious elements in a Nordic sense, I really do have to invite people to look at Rebellion. Absolutely my favorite, hands down.
What about Enslaved?
Enslaved, I've never actually listened to them.
Yeah, they're more like black metal with some.
Yeah, see, I'm not really into the black metal thing. For me, if they don't have clear vocals that I can understand what they're saying, I don't fuck with it.
Really, really.
I
grew up on death metal and black metal and stuff like that. Morbid Angel, Cannibal Corpse, Death, all that stuff. I'm a big thrash guy. I love thrash.
I'm very much like an 80s classical metal kind of guy. Like, Metal War is my jam.
I like some Manowar. Some of their stuff's okay. Some of their songs all sound the same, but like their earlier, one of their most popular songs that by moonlight we ride.
Yeah. Battle Hymns.
Yeah. Side by side. I don't know, but they're pretty.
Yeah,
good.
It was Battle Hymn.
Battle Hymn. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Righteous Glory is my favorite. Very slow instrumental. You know, I actually prefer all their instrumental orchestral ones the best. I don't know why.
Yeah, that guy can sing, too. He's got a good set of pipes.
Oh, absolutely.
What's his name? Joey something. I can't remember. But
Joey DeMaio is the guitarist.
Bass player.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I can't remember the singer, but he's got a good set of pipes. Man, we could do a whole show talking about metal. Maybe we should sometime.
I mean, it just seemed to be the connecting factor to everything. Everyone loves metal.
Everybody loves metal. Everybody likes 40K. Yeah. You know, I'm new to the party for 40K. I'm into it. I like it.
Well, as we know, 40K is the most metal of universes.
Yeah. It is totally, dude. It's so badass. But how about one more question, then we'll shut it down. We're coming up on 2 hours.
Sounds good.
Yeah, this is getting long. So, do we have any more? I think we did them all.
Oh, we did.
Oh, Roy Danton. This is a good one. This is going to be one for you. Could you possibly give us a brief overview of the Prose Edda? I know that we should only consider it to be a secondary source, but where would you put its importance in terms of recommended reading for somebody who's still fairly new to Ásatrú? And which edition would you recommend to read? Like, at which point during my discovery and learning of our ancient faith would you recommend me to read it?
You know, I actually take a position on the Prose Edda that's probably a bit more tolerant than most of the people in the Norona Society. I think that they are. It's a lesser source than the Prose Edda or the Poetic Edda, in that some of the myths here are different. It contains errors and compilation errors by Snorri and insertions, Christian insertions here and there. And some of the different myths start as a humorist base, and you really just have to watch out for the things that are clearly euhemerism or that could not possibly exist in an actual religion and understand in the historical context of what it's doing. But I don't believe that Snorri just invented the myth wholesale. I think he's retelling it in a Euhemer's position to get around, you know, like religious issues in the at the time, and you know, to himself. But yeah. I mean, that's not to say that they're totally useless. I think they're very, very important, and everyone should read them. And I do, in fact, consider the myth to be more or less true. You just have to excise out the bit and replace them with what we would know to be religiously correct.
Yeah, you have to. You just have to remember that what you're reading has contamination in it. It's read it now. Like, if you want to know when to read it, if you've read the Poetic Edda already, and you're especially if you're Roy, I know you're familiar with the Neurona Society content. If you're familiar with Neurona Society stuff, you're more than safe to go read Prosetta and be aware of the contamination and know where he's coming from and stuff like that. So,
right. My preferred translation here is the Broder translation. You can find it on Sacred Texts.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very easily accessible. You know, it's a perfectly good translation.
Volks Farmer says, "Hi to Volk." Yeah, that's the band, Hi to Volk. And he says,
"Oh, right, there we go." And, yeah, Hi to Volk's pretty great.
And he's talking about, he says, Heilung.
Heilung.
That's the band, yeah. I was talking about that does the primitivist stage production.
Right, that's the one that does that, you know, like the tribal chanting and whatnot.
Yeah, they're pretty cool, but you got to keep in mind they're not 100% authentic. They kind of like rip off a lot of Native American kind of stuff.
Almost none of these bands are 100% authentic, and most of them are like atheists who are like cashing in. Like, gonna be real, like it doesn't limit my enjoyment of their work, but you do have to understand that.
Yeah, and he also says,
except Falkenbach. I do have to put a plug on to Falkenbach. The dude's legit. He purposely did all the other religious elements on himself. He doesn't give interviews. He moved to Iceland. All of his songs have straight, strict religious elements that are devotional.
Very cool. Very cool. Can you spell that out for us?
Falkenbach is Falkenbach.
Yep.
I'll put it in the chat here.
And then Roy says, he's actually in the chat now, my buddy Roy says, "I'm actually going to reread the Poetic Edda. The version from the Neurona Society was one of the books that I really wanted to have." Yeah, hang on a second. I have right here the Odinist Edda. This is the one that I recommend for beginners. And this has elements of Prose Edda. This has the entire Poetic Edda. This has... he even has pieces from Orlinda book, and Mark really went crazy piecing together a really awesome, you know, piece of literature for us. I regard this is my go-to, the Odinist Edda, and I also have the Ostru Edda, but I prefer the Odinist Edda because I prefer the English stuff. And what's really awesome also in this, because he's got the Hugh runes, and that's, I'm not sure where that comes from, but it's a really cool spiritual read, even though it's not, you know, from the Poetic Edda or anything like that, but it's really cool stuff. It's, you know, this is it right here. This is the jam. This has to be on your shelf, either this one or the Ostru Edda. All right, Mr. Tristan, do you have anything else to add before we shut it down tonight?
No, I think we pretty much covered everything. I mean, we're at a little over 2 hours now, so.
Yeah, well, this is the longest show we've ever done, but.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we just had so much content to get out, especially with all those Q&As.
Oh, yeah, that was great. That was awesome. All right, brother, we're going to shut it down for tonight. But like always, guys, you know, follow here on DLive, like, subscribe, share over there on YouTube. And one final comment from me, man. It's crazy out there right now, and you know this is pretty scary stuff. You know, this is the plague of our time that we're going through. But I want everybody to keep in mind, stay calm. The overwhelming majority of us are going to survive this. Don't be scared. Don't fear. And you know, stay safe. Stay, Folks Farmer gives another Ninjini. Great 2 hours, guys. Thank you, Folks Farmer. Much love to you, brother. And everybody just stay safe. Make sure you have plenty of food. Remember that video I put out? Plenty of food, plenty of water, way to purify water, start germinating some seeds. As Folkish Farmer said, this is the time that we're going to need to start figuring, because it's very possible that the lights don't come back on, so to speak. It's very possible that
I really have to advise people, stay indoors. Don't go to them fucking corona parties. Tell your boss you're not going to die for his work.
Yeah.
You know, stay inside the house. Don't get infected. Be smart.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to have to, hopefully Dr. G, when he gets some time, will come back on, man. He's been telling us some stuff. This is, it's much worse than what they say on the news. This isn't just the flu. This is a respiratory virus that attacks your respiratory system and your breathing. And
you know what? I read that some men who, even young men who get infected with it and it rendered infertile. Don't fucking get it. Don't chance it, man.
There's so much crap with this virus. Do your best not to get it. If you have to stay indoors and be a hermit, do it. Do it. Don't take the chance. Yeah, most overwhelming majority of people don't get anything from this thing. But, who knows? Just be safe, guys. And don't be scared, because we'll be fine. And as I said earlier, this is our time, man. After this is all over, people are going to really see. They're going to see, man, that their lives had no meaning. And they're going to go searching for meaning. And they're going to find us. The Great Awakening is here.
We do have to remember that if we go down to, we have to raid our neighbors for the supplies, at least the Sky Father will protect us.
Yeah.
we have that advantage going for us. Yeah. Our gods are very good for this sort of thing.
It's very Indo-European. Very Indo-European to go take your neighbor's toilet paper. So, anyway, that's it for tonight, guys. Much love. Many blessings. Hail to the gods, and hail to you guys, and hail the folk, and everybody stay safe, stay healthy. I'll see you guys next week, 9 p.m. Eastern. Like, subscribe, share, click follow. We'll be back next week. Hail. See you guys next time.